Dr. Sorensen is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, having been at Penn since about 06, I believe, having worked before that at UCLA for more than 20 years, part of their Injury Control Research Center there at Penn, actually, sorry, at UCLA. She was one of the first, maybe the first person to teach a course in violence prevention in a School of Public Health, and she's one of the country's leading experts on the connection between intimate partner violence and firearms, which we'll talk about today. So thank you, Susan.
Thanks, Sean.
This topic is a bit different from the others because risk is not general. It's specific in that one known person is deemed to be a risk to another specific known person, to their health and safety. So I'm going to quickly review the phenomenon itself, because a good public health approach, that's where you say, let's describe the phenomenon and then determine the interventions. And then I'm going to talk about a few relevant policies. But as I begin, so that all of us don't end up needing chiropractic care by the end of this week, if not this day or session, go ahead and feel free to turn in your neck, because you got your speaker here and your talker, your slides over there, and I see people turning around and around and swiveling their necks. So feel free to do a little preventive work here. As I tell you that I, too, have no financial relationships to disclose. Okay. I'm going to tell you the bottom line first. Okay. So here are some key points. Three general key points. Is it the good news? Is that the general trend is downward in terms of intimate partner homicides? Bad news, there's still many deaths, and most of them are of women. Okay. And homicide risk is highest when she is ending the relationship. We'll turn back to these issues of exposure and particular high-risk times. Key points that I'm going to make about guns, that women are about 2.5 times as likely to be shot and killed by a male intimate as they are to be shot, stabbed, strangled, beaten, or killed in any other way by a stranger. Next is that homicides for domestic violence, handguns are the weapon of choice. And lastly, and this is a very important one in terms of the lives of women as well as the deaths of women, is that firearms are used to coerce as well as kill. And the research suggests that 9 times out of 10, it is a woman who is coerced. Okay. And the key points I want to make about policy interventions is that there are some solid policies in place. We need to monitor the implementation and enforcement of these legislative interventions. We need to evaluate them. And there's also room for innovative intervention. So let's first turn to the numbers. Okay. As you can see, as I said, the risk of homicide, and this is just simply the numbers. As the population's been growing, the numbers have been going down, so the rates would be even a more steep decline. But the risk of homicide, as I said, is highest when the woman tries to end the relationship, when she does exactly what society tells her to do. And this drop in homicides is similar to the drop in homicides that we're seeing all across the United States. There's not anything that's particularly unique about that. Okay. What we do see here is that it's dropped quicker and the slope is much more steep for men victims. Okay. Laura Dugan and others initially examined why this might be, and her work indicates that things like hotlines, domestic violence shelters, and such are preventing deaths, but largely they're preventing the deaths of men rather than women. During this time, men's intimate partner homicide by means other than guns have dropped in about half. Men's gun deaths from intimate partner homicide have dropped by 80%. Okay. For women, the non-gun homicides have remained relatively stable, whereas the gun homicides have dropped by about 40%. So this is some research, just some data that I had pulled together a while back that replicates what Mercy and Kellerman found, and I think it was 1996, maybe 1993, that a woman is 2.5 times as likely to be shot by her male intimate, as I said, as opposed to by a stranger. The green bars are that of any means by a stranger. Okay. And the dark blue bars is an intimate with a handgun, and the lighter blue on top is an intimate with a long gun. Okay. So that's focusing on fatalities. Now let's look at non-fatals. Okay. In a survey that was done already about 15 years ago, Pat Jaden and Nancy Thonens found that in the United States, this is a population-based survey, 3.5% of the women in the United States had a partner threaten them with a gun. Okay. And 0.7% had a gun used against them. Okay. This is a lifetime prevalence rate. So as public health people, you know, you might be inclined to kind of shrug and go, well, that's not very many, you know. That doesn't sound like a lot. But when we put numbers to that, we can see that using 2012 population data, that means about 4.5 million adult women were threatened by an intimate partner with a gun. Okay. And actually about 850,000 had a gun used against them. Okay. So just kind of staying with our convention cities, that means roughly every adult woman in Boston, in Denver, New Orleans, and although not a convention city for APHA in the past or likely to be in the future, Sacramento. But think of that as you leave the convention center today and you look around at the women who are working in the hotels, who are driving the cabs, who are serving you food, who are getting you through airport security. And next year, when we're in New Orleans, if all of those women, every single one of those, had a gun used against them by a male intimate. Okay. So these are population data, as I mentioned. Okay. And I'm going to transition now to battering relationships, and these are which there's ongoing behaviors, ongoing violence, multifaceted violence, you know, physical, sexual, psychological, economic, and that coercive control is at the center of it. Okay. Research that was done by Jackie Campbell, Daniel Webster, and others, that firearms present a unique risk factor for intimate partner homicide among abused women. In fact, abused women are about 5 times more likely to be killed by their abuser if the abuser owns a firearm. Okay. So, in terms of those who live with, not just die with, the guns, in a survey of 417 residents of 67 battered women's shelters in California, we found that guns were far more likely in the homes of that where battering had occurred. And specifically, handguns were 3 times more common in those homes as there were in homes in which of just the general population. And in 2/3 of those homes with one or more handguns, the partner had used the gun against the woman. Okay. So if the gun was used, most often, that's the yellow, it was used by the man to threaten to kill or threaten to shoot her. And 5% of the women were actually shot at or shot. We also found, and this goes back to the coercive control, that if the firearm was used against her, there were, on average, 8 times or 8 other types of weapons versus about 4.5 if there wasn't. So the point being is that you don't have to beat a woman, which is our stereotype of battering, if you've got a gun. You can coerce her into doing things and coerce her into having other weapons used against her as well. Okay. So in sum, on that, women are 2.5 times as likely to be shot. Handguns are the weapon of choice. Firearms are used to coerce as kill. Now, turning to specific policies, okay, let's look at the primary policies that we have in place right now. And they started with the 1994 Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act, which was part of the Violence Against Women Act, VAWA. And this focuses on those who are prohibited from purchasing and possessing a firearm. Okay. And that law added persons under certain domestic violence restraining orders. Not all, but certain ones. And domestic violence restraining orders, also known as protection from abuse orders, are available in all 50 states. Who can actually get them varies. Some states minors can, sometimes they can't. Sometimes people who are gay and lesbian can get them, sometimes they can't. Sometimes unmarried people don't qualify, sometimes they do. So this is what we get into, some of the diversity in the laws that exist. Okay. Most women get a restraining order when she's trying to end the relationship. Okay, which is also when she's at highest risk of being murdered by them. And it's important to note that most restraining orders are violated, about 71%. Okay. And we also found in research in California, Kate Vitties and I did, that about 10% of the women who were murdered by an intimate partner had a current restraining order on it. And for those who ever had one, either a current or a past one, they had repeated orders. They had repeatedly sought protection for this. So these federal laws require enabling state legislation. And one of the most important things probably these state expansions have done is that they've included people that who weren't married, okay, because the federal law said that you had to have been married, cohabiting, or have a child in common. Okay. Well, we know boyfriends and ex-boyfriends are one of the most common categories for perpetrators of intimate partner homicide, but they were not included unless you had were living with them or had a child in common. Okay. Also, some states include temporary restraining orders, which is important because the high-risk time is when she goes to initially seek a restraining order as she's ending the relationship. These things require prompt entry into an electronic database. Okay. Another important legislative intervention came a bit later, and that was the Lautenberg Amendment. And that added persons who were convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence. Misdemeanor was added because it's really hard to get a felony conviction in intimate partner violence. Okay. It can be the same level of injury, weapon use, aggravated assault, as what's called if it's with strangers. Okay. But that's harder to get when the people know each other, and particularly when they've had an intimate relationship. So misdemeanors were added. Felonies were already prohibited. Okay. And states, again, had to have the enabling legislation, and those that added it often included like dating partners and such. So that made it they're broader in general. In 2008, President George W. Bush signed into law the National Instant Check System Improvement Act. It actually was not a federal or unfunded federal mandate. It was a federal mandate that came with funding so that states could use that federal funding and apply for it to get additional funding to improve the quality of the information that came. This was largely in response to the shootings at Virginia Tech because many of the mental health records were not entered. It still aren't, as we have learned. An astute staffer asked me to testify on this. Daniel was testified as well, but to testify, and I was one of the only person that testified about domestic violence work. And so we're thrilled that that was added in for that. So these things, it's purchase and possession. Purchase is, relatively speaking, easy. Possession is really a challenge because it involves relinquishment and removal from the person who's not supposed to have it. And there's been law enforcement resistance to that, which there isn't time to go into, but I just got the two-minute warning, so I'll return to that in question and answer session if there's time. Okay. So the 2008 review of laws by the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence reported similar numbers to those that were reported by Shannon Frateroli and Jan Verdink in 2006, that here are the number of states that had laws authorizing police to remove guns, allowing courts to issue guns removed. 10 states had both laws, 26 had neither. Okay. And there is a lot of diversity in this. In fact, for example, in Pennsylvania, police are authorized, not required, but they're authorized to remove the gun that's used during a domestic violence incident. Okay. He can have an arsenal on the wall, but it's only that one gun that he used to threaten her with, or to shoot her at, with, that can be removed. It's like sort of like bad gun, bad gun. It was that gun, you know. It's not the concept of the firearm. So there are evaluation and implementation challenges. The challenges specifically for evaluations, I've indicated, laws differ. There's uneven implementation and enforcement. There's a low base rate also of intimate partner homicide, which makes it hard to detect differences. There have been a handful of evaluations to date done by some people here in this room. And Dugan et al., Vigdor and Mercy, and Zioli and Webster. And these were laws that covered, or most of this analysis covered up to 2003. They found differing amounts, but overall the modest effects. And the laws that seem to be most effective are those of restraining orders and warrantless arrest when there's been a violation of restraining orders, and that they are associated with drops of 15% to 20% of intimate partner homicide. So a few closing thoughts. One is good news. We might be able to say more in a few years, okay? In that it looks like the federal restriction on firearms research might be lifted, and there might be funding, actually, for additional gun research so that we might have more current information to tell you. Also, I've talked about the laws that are specific to intimate partner violence, but I think it's really important that we look beyond those. And knowing that a number of you in the room are attorneys, I thought I would end with a few cases. Okay. Specifically, Stand Your Ground, a Florida case that you might not have heard of, because it's not about Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, but about Marissa Alexander, who had a restraining order against her husband, who she was separated from, and he was coming at her, strangled her, pushed her, and she was trying to get away. She ran out to the garage, realized she didn't have the keys to get out, and also the garage door wouldn't open. She ran back in the house, grabbed her gun, and was trying to get out. He came at her again and saying, "Bitch, I'm going to kill you." She said she took her gun, shot it up, made one shot up towards the top of a wall by the ceiling. Okay. He called the police, said that she was trying to shoot him and the kids. She was brought to trial, and in 12 minutes was convicted for 20 years, okay. Even though no one was hurt, and even though she did not point the gun at anyone. 2 weeks ago, a federal appellate court in Florida overturned her conviction, saying that the jury had received flawed instructions on self-defense. Okay. She remains incarcerated. Okay. Another is internet sales. Okay. Zena Houghton had a restraining order against her estranged husband. She worked in a spa in Wisconsin. He went online. He couldn't buy a gun locally. I don't know if he tried. I don't have that level of detail of information, but he got his 40 caliber pistol on armslist.com, where you can go online and buy guns. He shot and killed her, then killed and wounded others at the spa, then killed himself. This week, her brother is presenting a petition. Her brother, an NRA member, by the way, is presenting a petition with 60,000 signatures to Congress to take a look at online sales. And a last example is long gun background checks. There's groups in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. They're trying to organize to get background checks on long guns as well as handguns, which is not always common in a lot of states. But thank you.
Well, thank you, Susan. As promised, we've purposely left a good amount of time for questions at the end. There's no microphones in the audience area, so if you have a question, I'll call on you. If you wouldn't mind standing up and just speaking loud, and I'll repeat or summarize the question just so the whole room can hear. So we're quite happy to take. Yes, sir. Please.
What's the meaning of the word heteroskedastic?
heteroskedasticity.
I'm going to let Jan handle that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, happy to.
I didn't expect to get that in a law session. It has to do with unequal variance in common in most standard regression. There's an assumption of equal variance, and of course that's not always the case, particularly when you're looking at state level gun data. So you have to adjust standard errors accordingly. So that's my.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you for asking that question. So the first category that was listed was permit to purchase with discretion. So there's only, I believe, three states that where law enforcement can use discretion in issuing a permit, as I indicated before. Massachusetts were in one of those states, New Jersey and New York as well. There are remaining states that have a similar process of fingerprinting, go to local law enforcement, but do not give local law enforcement that discretion. So the biggest effect was when you had discretion, but even without discretion, you've still had a pretty substantial effect.
Mostly you put heteroskedasticity on your slide just to look cool. Right? Yes, sir. Do I need to repeat the questions, or are you able to hear them throughout the room? Mostly, yes. Well, the questions had to do with the effects of gun laws and other policies on suicide. And before I let David and Susan respond, we didn't really talk very much about suicide. David did a little bit here. The majority, as many of you probably know, the majority of all gun-related deaths in the United States each year are suicide, and there are actually more suicides by gunfire in the United States than there are suicides by every other method combined. So it's an enormous public health problem. David, did you want to?
So one of the few things we really know in the gun world is that a gun in the home is a risk factor for suicide. I mean, there's been so many studies now. Do the laws matter? I don't think we really know for sure. What we can say is that areas where there are few guns typically are also areas where there are strong laws. And in those areas, there are a lot fewer suicides. And it's hard to disentangle the effects of the laws versus the effect of how many guns there are. But the key thing really is the number of guns in the home, because almost all these guns are legal guns, and who's dying from the guns are the gun owner, the gun owner's wife, the gun owner's children. So most of the laws probably could have a minor effect, but these people are almost always, quote, decent law-abiding citizens who could pass a Brady background check.
Actually, having been in the audience, I know that you won't be heard adequately, if you don't mind.
Most, as you point out, most of the mass casualty shootings in the United States do involve intimate partner violence. They're not the school shootings. And I think that's a big part of the problem, is that if the issues and the numbers that I talked about are only with the suspect and the victim, okay? Whereas we know that if a man goes in and shoots all of his kids and kills himself to get at his wife because they're divorcing and doesn't want her to have custody, okay? That's going to show up in our statistics as father-child. Okay, when actually that was a domestic violence motivated deaths. But those numbers don't end up, as you could see, it's the suspect-victim relationship. And so I think your point is really important, that if we start to look at these not just from that relationship standpoint, but what motivated that, we're going to end up with those numbers that I showed you being a lot higher. Yeah, the homicide-suicide, you see that in these sort of mass shootings, whether it's school-based or whether it's family-based. And it's people who are just gotten so desperate that they're going to take out others as well as themselves. And if you've got something more cogent that you wanted to be saying, you're prompting him, I'm going to let him say it himself, you know?
So, when we've looked at homicide followed by suicide, it's a small percentage of all the homicides, but it's a very, very large percentage. It's over half of all the interpartner violence homicides caused by guns. So probably 60% of the time when the man kills the woman with a gun, he then very quickly kills himself. And if you look at the background of these men, they look more like suicides than they do like typical homicide perpetrators. They do not look like street gang members who are doing this. And so there's a notion that getting mental health to these people could, to the men, could actually prevent the homicide as well as suicide. In the Air Force, when they really tried to reduce suicide in the Air Force, and they had all these problems to get people who are at high risk for big problems because they're in trouble with the law or finances or whatever, and they're going through a terrible period. They tried to get help to them, to get them to seek help to reduce the risk of suicide, and they really did. There's an incredible success story. But at the same time, there was this secondary great success that also reduced the likelihood of intimate partner violence.
I'll just mention very quickly also with regard to suicide, there's some evidence that safe storage laws require that guns be stored safely, can reduce teen homicides. That's research. Teen suicides. That's research that Daniel has led and that I was part of, and that there's also some maybe even more modest research that suggests that the waiting periods associated with the Brady Law might have reduced homicides among older people. I keep saying homicides. I apologize. Suicides. Thank you. Yes, sir, up in front.
So politicians and lobbyists are really led data and activism in a way. I'm curious, when you show all that stuff on Missouri,
any change? Did they affect new laws? Because I thought you were in Colorado, so they have affected laws, but not one. You all could hear the question is the impact of the research data on politicians and laws, in particular the Missouri data that Dano presented.
You know, I'm well aware, of course, that there are a lot of factors that go into making laws, and maybe only a small aspect of that is data. Now, in Maryland, we actually put in a pretty comprehensive package of stronger gun laws this past spring, including a permit to purchase licensing system that we previously did not have, and some of the Missouri data feature prominently in that. Actually, I have to say that I had a longer-term plan to examine the effect of Missouri's permit to purchase repeal. I had a meeting with some state legislators in Annapolis where I had originally, we had the data on trafficking and diversion showing some immediate harmful effect. And he immediately dismissed that, and he said, what about gun crime? And I said, well, I guess I better go look at it. And I went back that night to take a look, and I saw such a startling and immediate change that I put this on fast forward. And actually, I think it was impactful to some degree in Maryland. So there are some people on the margins who I think will respond. And again, You know, I showed you the data on public support for this kind of, the general idea that we should keep guns from dangerous people is not a controversial idea. It's widely held value and idea, gun owners and not. And permit to purchase licensing is just a mechanism to do that. I think it's harder when we have other types of policies that you can't frame very easily in that way, where you get into more common knee-jerk pro-gun, anti-gun kind of stuff.
Yes, sir. Say again. Well, if there was ever a panel that's unlikely to shoot you, it's got to be this one. So rather than try to refer that question to the philosophy or the history departments, I'll tell you what Justice Scalia said in District of Columbia against Heller with regard to this Second Amendment individual right that he identified within the Second Amendment. He said that, like all rights, that right is not absolute. And maybe we mistakenly sometimes think of other rights like the First Amendment right to free speech or political association. That's subject to regulation when it can be well justified. Justice Scalia said that militia language referred to all able-bodied citizens. That's why he was able to find a broad individual right that was disconnected from militia service, as many prior courts had in fact connected it. Whether you agree with that or not, I think the bottom line of a case like District of Columbia against Heller is laws that entirely ban handguns are clearly being rendered invalid by the courts. But virtually every other kind of law you can think of has been overwhelmingly upheld since Heller. So there are many people, myself included, who think of Heller as sort of a good news kind of statement. It means that there's banning handguns was never really on the serious political agenda of the United States. So taking that constitutionally off the table is not a big loss for the gun violence prevention movement. But being able to say to the world that has always feared that every small new law that gets enacted is the first step down the slippery slope towards confiscation of all handguns, being able to say to them, not only was that never our intention, but we constitutionally can't do it. Even if you were afraid of it, it's off the table. While at the same time being able to say, but most everything else, short of banning handguns, appears to be permissible. So I would give you a more practical as opposed to philosophical or historical answer. Yes, ma'am. So,
talk about changing social norms, and I live in Louisiana, but they'll never, ever do a kind of thing. But what I want to know is what can you do to make people, gun owners, responsible for when their guns are used in another way?
Well, so first of all, I would say even even, God forbid, in Louisiana. Don't give up hope on changing social norms. Look at what's happened with the social norm change around smoking, or the social norm change that David mentioned around rather than focusing exclusively on the driver of the car to focusing on the car itself. Smoking changes have been enormous, not just in New York City, but so David was trying to whisper something at me. Did you want to?
No, dueling.
Oh, there was the social norm over dueling, apparently, as a way to resolve disputes, and that obviously has changed as well. So to get back to your precise question, so there's sort of two answers. You don't have to be a gun dealer or distributor. You don't have to have a license unless you engage in the regular sale of guns to make money, basically, rather than just to sell occasionally as part of your collection. But that's a different question than ought you to bear some responsibility if you transfer your gun to someone else. Now, in states that require a background check before transferring that gun, that's the whole point, actually, is to hold the person who fails to engage in that background check, to hold them criminally responsible, to not just go after the person who does the crime. Did you want to? You look like you were poor. Go ahead. Okay. So there, with regard to safe storage, whatever David asks me to do, he tells me to do it, I do it. So there are, I believe, 18 states now that have child access prevention laws that say that if you are going to bring a gun into your home, you have to store it safely so that children, and the age varies from state to state, children and teens can't gain easy access to it, and it's crime if you fail to do that. Now, what triggers the crime also varies. Sometimes the kid actually has to find the gun and use it to threaten or harm someone else. There have been a number of studies. There's actually some very consistent research that shows that that those child access prevention laws reduce accidental, that is, unintentional deaths among children. And I mentioned the research that Daniel led with regard to the fact that these laws seem to also prevent teen suicide. Not surprising. If a teen's going to commit suicide with a gun, the research overwhelmingly shows that he doesn't go to try to buy one on the black market. He uses the gun that's in the home or in a relative's home. The other encouraging thing about cap laws is if you look at the states that have them, again, like with dealer licensing, there are a handful of, quote, red states that have these kinds of laws. They ought to be enactable even in a state like Louisiana. Do you want to add?
I was going to make that last point because there are states like Texas, for example, that actually have these safe storage laws, and there are a number of states like that. The general idea that we want to protect young people is kind of universal, I think. So I think that's possible. I guess one thing I just sort of put on the table for consideration is when you don't have the private sales regulations are already there, I wonder if it might be possible to explore legislation where there's some accountability held when you had some information that suggests that the person you're transferring the firearm to maybe wasn't the most safe, responsible person. Now, right now, if you knowingly transfer to a felon, that's a federal law violation. But I wonder if there's something that's sort of short of that where you know, for example, the person has a problem with substance abuse, or you know the person has had a history of domestic violence, yet you're going to still transfer the firearm. So I just sort of wonder if there might be other things we haven't thought about yet.
Interesting idea. We'll be happy to work with you. It looks like we have time for just one more question. Yes, ma'am? We can't hear you up front, yeah. do you want to speak? Okay, Susan wants to respond, I think, or add something to that.
This picks up on the idea that I had talked about, that there's law enforcement resistance to having the guns relinquished. Law enforcement impounds cars regularly. They figure out how to impound cars. Okay? They can figure out how to store the 15 handguns you're talking about would fit in a small file drawer. Okay? So this has to do with political will and figuring out how to make it happen. There are ways to make it happen. They can outsource this to somebody else. There can be storage lockers. They can do this. This is something that can be done.
Yeah, sure.
Again, on a positive note, we did a demonstration project evaluating an intervention in two California counties to disarm individuals who had restraining orders for domestic violence. One of those counties was a rural county, Butte County, and when we first went in there, we got the same old story about, oh, there's no way we're going to be able to do this because of how would we store all these guns and so on and so forth. Fast forward over a 2.5-3 year period, it ended up that they managed this process actually quite well and really had basically no blowback from any place. So they were actually able to do it even though they went into it skeptical.
Great, thank you. Well, I want to thank the panel one more time. And thank the law section and those of you who are either lawyers or policy analysts, policy experts. This is an area where you are needed. Law affects social norms. It affects whether dangerous people ultimately have access to guns. So we need all of your help, and I hope I'll see you at a session like this again next time. Thank you.